Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The state of Ohio and the city of Columbus have cited the so-called Art Modell Law in their lawsuit against Major League Soccer and Columbus Crew Soccer Club owner Anthony Precourt over his plan to move the team to Austin, Texas. Joining us now by phone is journalist Chris Bills. He's been covering the story for the Austin American Statesman. Welcome, Chris Bills.
Hi, Anna. Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Give us the primer on what the Modell is, the Modell Law is, just a thumbnail.
Yeah, so let me find my brief. It's kind of convoluted. It's Ohio Revised Code 9.67, which is an untested and apparently unprecedented statute enacted in 1996 after the Cleveland Browns moved to Baltimore. The owner at the time was Art Modell. And it's designed to prevent sports owners whose teams play in tax-supported facilities and receive financial assistance from the state or local governments from ceasing play at those facilities unless they receive permission from the state and local governments or give 6 months advance notice of their intentions to move.
And give them an opportunity to buy the team. Yeah.
Sorry, I mean, I was trying to keep it short for you.
Yeah, that's okay. I mean, Precourt did give 6 months notice.
Well, see, that's going to be one of the first hurdles that the state, I think, has to prove is that that he has given notice that he's going to leave because, technically he hasn't said that he is moving yet. They're still trying to find a suitable stadium site in Austin. Meanwhile, the team's continuing to play in Columbus, so there hasn't been a move announced yet. And so I think that's the first thing the state's going to have to argue is whether this law is enforceable yet because it technically may not have been broken.
What did he announce last October then?
So he announced in October that he was exploring a potential move, exploring his strategic options was, I think, the way that they worded it then. But since then, obviously, he's kind of shown an intention or definitely shown an intention to move to Austin. It's just a matter of finding the right site and getting all the pieces in place to make that move happen. Yeah.
I guess it's unclear whether or not this is going to be managed by the Modell Law because it's because he's been vague in how he's announcing the departure.
Well, it's not just that he's been vague, but the law itself is fairly vague. The state's going to have to prove that Mafre Stadium is a tax supported facility. The complaint outlines about $6 million in different incentives that were given or subsidies that were given to the club for parking improvements and things like that. But the actual stadium itself was not built using tax dollars. Lamar Hunt, the original owner of the team, built it with private funds mm-hmm. on public land. And then they have to kind of define what giving an opportunity to purchase the team is going to mean, how do those negotiations have to be handled? It's not really clear in the law. The law is fairly vague. So that's the first thing that law experts have told me, that's going to be the first hurdle is how determining how vague the law is and if it's enforceable because of that.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We are talking about the Art Modell Law, so-called, because it was enacted after former Cleveland Browns owner Art Modell moved that franchise to Baltimore. The question, though, that was back in 1996 when the law was enacted, and since then it's never been tested. My guest, Chris Bills, sports reporter for Austin American Statesman. Chris, you said that it's an unprecedented law. Are you saying that there's no other law like it in the country?
There doesn't seem to be. No, I talked to several sports law experts, and nobody seems to be able to find anything that's quite like this. There's been several lawsuits that have been levied against teams, most notably, I think, New Orleans when the Jazz moved to Utah, sued the owners of that team. They weren't successful, and the team had already moved by the time that the lawsuit went through the courts. So that's the closest thing anybody could really, come to saying, anything similar to this. But as far as an actual law, that keeps sports teams from moving. Now, this is fairly unprecedented.
Is there any sense that Mr. Precourt and his people have worded the departure the way they have in anticipation of a lawsuit citing this, the Modell Law?
I don't know that that's the case. I do think that, in an interview with us, with the Austin American-Statesman, just two weeks ago, Anthony Precourt, said that this move is not at all costs. This is not a done deal by any stretch. And if they don't get what they're looking for in Austin, mm-hmm. then the move may not happen at all. So I don't think that they've worded the move because of the law as much as just because it's not set in stone yet.
How does the lawsuit affect preparations for the crew in Austin?
So far, it hasn't affected things at all. You've seen the progress that they've tried to make. They announced yesterday a community benefits package. Kind of released some community benefits that could be derived from a stadium at the location that they're looking at now. To city council, they haven't changed their approach at all.
But as far as raising money for a stadium and for the improvements that would have to be made around any kind of stadium, has that been affected? I mean, how much are people really going to want to invest?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I think if a preliminary injunction were to be granted, obviously, that could hold the move up, and at that point, maybe you might see the proceedings affected in Austin. But so far, we haven't seen that.
A UCLA professor specializing in sports law told you that even if the state wins at the lower level, the lawsuit could be problematic for fundraising in Austin for the stadium there. Is that what he was talking about?
Yeah, Stephen Bank. Yeah, I had a great conversation with him, and yeah, he did say that could affect things in Austin if the preliminary injunction's granted, and it's unclear whether the team's moving at all. Obviously, then companies and potentially the government or the city leadership here would be a little bit wary of continuing to work with this team. But like I said, so far there's been no indication of whether this law is even going to. Even going to go through because it is so vague.
You recently quoted an Austin-based sports lawyer as saying that the Modell Law isn't the biggest obstacle in moving the team to Texas. He said there are bigger obstacles in Austin. What was he talking about?
Well, so far it's been quite the saga in Austin. Initially they wanted to put the stadium at Butler Shores Metropolitan Park, which is a cluster of baseball fields downtown, but it is parkland, and that raised a lot of eyebrows in Austin. Parkland is sacred here, as the locals will tell you, and the city leadership as well. So, they were looking at Guerrero, Roy G. Guerrero Metropolitan Park out on the east side as well, and activists were continuing to protest that, and so now they're looking at McCalla Place, a location about 11 miles north of downtown, near the Domain Shopping Center, which is a vibrant area of town. We're gonna see in the next couple months here, when City Council is able to talk about it, if they're gonna be able to move forward with that location. But those are the obstacles that Precourt Sports Ventures has been trying to navigate so far, is finding the correct site.
What's the layout of Austin like? One of the things about where the stadium is located in Columbus is it is kind of far, although there's a growing entertainment sector kind of moving in the direction of it. By and large, mm-hmm. most of the 22 years it's been there, it's been kind of isolated from the hop in downtown area. So what about Austin? How is it laid out? Is parkland tend to be the only large open spaces that are developable?
Yeah, really the only large open spaces that are publicly owned seem to be near downtown, seem to be those parkland locations. And then when you talk about the area north of the city, this McCalla Place location, mm-hmm. it is the Domain is kind of commonly referred to as a second downtown. It's near the population center of the city. For Columbus people, I've kind of compared it a little bit to Easton Town Center, but it's really even more expansive than that with the businesses and the growth that's happening up there.
What kind of sports culture is in Austin? It's a college town, obviously, but beyond that, I mean, we know we have the Buckeyes here, and now we have the Blue Jackets and the Crew.
Yeah.
What's Austin like?
Yeah, in some ways, it's kind of similar to Columbus, right? I mean, the Texas Longhorns are the big show in town. You know, football is the big sport here, and the Longhorns are really it as far as college or professional. But there is a growing young population here. Millennials, as the league will tell you, Major League Soccer is marketing itself to millennials, and a lot of them aren't from here, so they're looking for something that's their own. They're looking for a professional team that they can kind of rally behind, and that's been kind of a main selling point so far.
And what are the prospects for an expansion team in Austin if this becomes too much of a pain? Is Austin kind of shooting for something no matter what?
Well, right now they're not part of the expansion process. There's 11 cities that are vying for a Major League Soccer team. Austin wasn't part of that initial process. There's no ownership group that stepped forward, although Bobby Epstein, the owner of the chairman of Circuit of the Americas, the Formula One track outside town, has been, said he's going to launch a USL franchise, a second division franchise, also in 2019. So there's that. But as far as Major League Soccer, there's really no rumblings of anything outside of this.
Is there a big soccer culture there beyond the millennials?
Well, it's been interesting. The history of professional soccer here has been, somewhat unfortunate in some ways. They had a USL franchise that ended up moving to Orlando, became Orlando City FC. Then they launched a second version of the Aztecs, is what the USL franchise is called, and they were playing at a stadium near downtown. They got flooded. They had to move north of the city. And they ended up having to go on hiatus. They weren't allowed to sell alcohol at the high school stadium that they were playing at. And so they haven't really been able to create much of a soccer culture, although, I will say that there's a lot of people that are very interested in the prospect of a Major League Soccer team. And there's certainly interest in soccer in the city, plenty of youth soccer and things like that.
And city leaders, are they on board? What kind of package did they offer up the other day?
Yeah, so they've said that a stadium at McCullough Place would provide in excess of $326 million was the figure given. The city council received that yesterday, and can read a quick quote from Kathy Tovo, who's been kind of heading up this process, has said she's enthusiastic about continuing to explore McCullough site. It offers a lot of promise. I appreciate the effort by Precourt made to make sure community benefits are part of the conversation from the outset. So, I mean, they like the approach that's been taken. I think they have been kind of waiting for this, and now the conversation can kind of begin about what they'd like to see as far as community benefits go. And, that conversation still hasn't moved forward. And so that's really the next step. I will say that many of the community leaders have said that while they didn't want to see the stadium on parkland, they do want to see a soccer team here. So I think you're going to see that moving forward, that while they may have been fairly negative about parkland being used, they still would like to see this move forward.
And what role has Major League Soccer played in all of these negotiations and dealings?
So far, it's been, Precourt Sports Ventures. President Dave Greeley has kind of been the point man for them. And then Richard Settle, who's a local lobbyist, fairly well known here in Austin circles. And he's under contract by Major League Soccer and Precourt Sports Ventures. And so really that's been the team on the ground here from the league perspective.
I should mention that Precourt Sports Ventures declined our invitation to speak on the issue of departure from Columbus in the pending suit. Chris Bills, thanks to you for joining us. I appreciate your time today.
Yeah, thanks so much, Ann. Thanks for having me.
Chris Bills is a sports reporter. He's been covering the issue of the departure of the Columbus Crew Soccer Club for the Austin American-Statesman. More coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. In 1995, late Senator John Glenn spoke on the Senate floor about Browns owner Art Modell moving the team from Cleveland to Baltimore.
Every community with a professional sports team needs to know this. Any city in America can fall victim to a bidding war in which the interests of loyal fans and communities are given very little consideration. Quite simply, if it can happen in Cleveland, where loyal fans supported the Browns through thick and thin, then, Mr. President, it can happen anywhere.
Senator Glenn's warning has come to pass in Columbus, which is set to lose the Columbus Crew Soccer Club after calling Ohio's capital city home for 22 years. Although Senator Glenn's efforts didn't lead to federal legislation and Ohio law was passed to prevent future such departures, it has come to be known as the Modell Law and is designed to delay or deny the right to move a team when the public funding has been involved. The state and city of Columbus have cited the Modell Law in a lawsuit against the owner of the Crew, Anthony Precourt, who announced last fall intentions to move the team possibly to Austin, Texas in 2019. Joining us now by phone is State Representative Mike Duffy of the 21st District. Welcome to the show.
Good morning, Ann.
You first mentioned the Modell Law as a response to Precourt. How does that law fit the circumstances here?
Well, so I have it right in front of me. I'm going to kind of read it to you because it's actually fairly short. No owner of a professional sports team that uses a tax-supported facility for most of its home games and receives financial assistance from the state or a political subdivision thereof shall cease playing most of its home games at that facility and begin playing most of its home games elsewhere unless the owner either A, enters into an agreement with the political subdivision, in this case Columbus would have to give them permission, we know that's not going to happen, or B, gives the political subdivision which the facility is located not less than 6 months advance notice of the owner's intention to cease playing most of its home games at the facility, and during that 6 months gives the political subdivision or any individual or group of individuals that reside in the area the opportunity to purchase the team. In my opinion, based on a plethora of state funding and supports that the Crew have received, they clearly triggered this law. And the law was passed June 20th, 1996. The Crew didn't really come into existence until just shortly after that, almost like 1 year after that. And then really the stadium came a couple years later after that. And then the Crew ownership at that time, which was the Hunts, hired lobbyists, went out, sought public funding in different ways, including $5 million for the parking lot, a below-market lease. They only pay $72,000 a year for the land. They leased that from the state of Ohio, so that's state taxpayers' support as well. And then they sought and received a property tax exemption. They pay no property taxes. Normally, if you have a private facility, even if it's on state land, you do pay property taxes. And so I think all of that qualifies as a tax-supported facility, and therefore they're subject to the Modell Law.
The law is untested and perhaps unprecedented. People who have been looking into it don't see any other example like it out there. What do you think are the greatest challenges to tapping this law in this case?
So I think, you know, probably what Precourt Sports Ventures will attempt to do is remove it from state court. Obviously, it's the state of Ohio and it's a state law, so I would expect that we would have a likelihood of success in Ohio. I think the language of the law is fairly clear and fairly obvious and very reasonable. In a sense, you can think of it as a tax incentive clawback or an investment by the state of Ohio. Basically, the state of Ohio is saying, you don't have to take state money. You don't have to take city taxpayer money. But if you do, here's the contract that you've entered.
So it's an overarching contract. Usually when there's state funding or, you know, whether it's some kind of tax increment financing or anything like that, there's usually a deal struck at the time. You have to stay here for this many years and you have to create this many jobs. But that's not the case with this law.
It's not the necessarily the case on the parking lot that they said you must stay here and that that was written into like a signed document of some kind. Mm-hmm. But there's an implied contract of state law, which is you knew what the law was. You're expected. Ignorance is no excuse when it comes to you. You're a sophisticated entity. You're the MLS, right? You've got high paid, probably New York attorneys. They can look through the state of Ohio's laws before you actually seek the public funding. And they probably made a mistake. Honestly, they wanted something for nothing. They want state taxpayers to fund a facility, and they expect no restrictions on that. Now, if a company goes for jobs incentive, the principle is that if they don't deliver, we claw back that money, right? Well, the clawback on this money, which was in the revised code since 1996, is here's what the restriction is. You don't have to seek state money or city money, but if you do, this is the obligation. And so that they were aware of that before they accepted that. If they weren't aware of it, it's not the state of Ohio's fault that they weren't aware of it. It was in black and white in the Ohio law.
How did this idea occur to you? I remember when it was passed, but
my nephew, I forgot about it. Yeah, I was at a barbecue with my nephew, and he's a big sports fan, and he had another friend who was an attorney who pointed this out. Now, it had crossed my mind that a law like this existed, but I had taken for granted what was commonly reported in most media outlets kind of leading up to this, which was that the stadium was privately funded, et cetera. And everyone just kind of assumed that. And I think there was broadly not an awareness of what public money had gone into it. And to be honest, I didn't know what public money had gone into it. And so for a month after hearing this from my nephew, I thought, well, this is a curiosity that we have a law like this, but it doesn't apply in my mind, probably, because there's no state money involved. And then I was doing a presentation to Creative Ohio, which is the Ohio Arts Council and Ohio History Connection. Mm-hmm. And I was looking through state capital bill funding. I was trying to give people advice. Well, here's how you go seek capital bill funding. I saw in the last budget, we had a $5 million appropriation for the training facility for the crew in OBETS. And I thought, oh my God, smoking gun. Here's $5 million for this purpose, or a million or whatever it was. I forget mm-hmm. what the total dollar amount was. As it turns out, that money was never distributed because they never utilized it and they never proceeded with it. And I thought, oh, you know, what a loss. We don't have this to attach to the law. But then I asked the Ohio Legislative Service Commission, can you help me research any public money that's gone into this facility in any way, what shape or form? And then we started uncovering thing after thing after thing, and very substantial amounts of money. $5 million into parking lot revenues, mm-hmm. Parking lot improvements. And by the way, they have a contract on that parking lot that they get a majority of the revenues, even when it's not a crew game. So if there's a concert there, the crew actually gets the revenue from the parking lots, not the state of Ohio for the most part. And so the improvement to that parking lot also, you remember Mark McCullers was the general manager at one point, and mm-hmm. he was in either Business First or the Columbus Dispatch, and I think it was the Dispatch. And he says, fans were complaining about our facility. We needed to improve the parking lot because our facility was not meeting expectations. And I thought, well, that's exactly the language in the Ohio Revised Code. It says a tax-supported facility. And the crew's general manager is describing the parking lot, which is owned by the Ohio Expo Center, mm-hmm. as part of their facility. And everyone who looks at that would rationally say, well, that parking lot, it is primarily there for the crew. And if they, not only is it there just to support them, but they're actually deriving revenues off of it. You know, that plus the below market lease, plus the tax exemption on the property itself, I think satisfies the letter of the law.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. I'm talking with State Representative Mike Duffy. He was person who first raised the question of whether or not the so-called Modell Law would apply in the case of the Crew. The owner has announced last October that he wants to move the Crew. We're not sure where technically yet, but he's looking at Austin very, very seriously. Joining us now is James Maniacci. He's a partner in Taft Law. Taft Law is not involved in any of this litigation, but he has been commenting on the topic. Welcome to the show, James.
Good morning, Ann. I hope you're doing well today.
Thank you. I am. And also joining us, Morgan Hughes. He's a leader in the Save the Crew movement. Welcome, Morgan.
Hi, Ann. Thanks for having me.
Morgan, what do you think the role of fans should be at this stage?
Well, you know, from a Save the Crew perspective, from day one, we wanted to be the voice of the voiceless. And I think that's where we do our best work. When you talk about Crew SC possibly leaving Columbus, you're not talking about a fan base. You're talking about a community of real human beings who feel powerless after 20 plus years of supporting this team and this city with their hearts and with their pocketbooks. They don't have a voice all of a sudden. And that's where we decided it's not good enough. So we sought to amplify the feelings of our community and to have those in power, those who can make a difference, know what this means to us, know what this means to our community, and to have them act accordingly. Our message has been from day one, this is not over. It's not over. Tell everyone you know. Raise awareness. Hashtag Save the Crew. So that's what we've done, and that's where we're at.
It's felt kind of over, though, for a lot of people. They think this is, I don't know, I know there's some sports analogy out there, Hail Mary type of thing, this lawsuit. How do you keep people invigorated on this topic?
Well, anybody who says that this is over is wrong, flat out. It's not. And believe me, I'm enough of a realist to not want to invest my time and energy in something that's frankly over. We sought to get in contact with the people who go into the boardrooms where decisions are made that we can't be a part of, and to tell them exactly what we thought and why they should do everything possible to save this team. And it's worked, and it's working. Yeah, I can be accused of being an optimist sometimes, and that's true. But all signs point to this not being over. And, until it's over, we're going to keep fighting. And when it is over, it's going to be with the Crew staying in the only home it's ever had.
James Maniacci, what can you just give us a sense about how long a litigation like this could go on with an unprecedented, untested law such as the Modell Law in play?
Yeah, it could go on for years. If usually litigation like this is settled, mm-hmm. Now it just at some point something is going to happen that's going to force the parties' hands. For example, if the state and the city can't obtain an order preventing the move, then the steps may be taken that the move happens and the lawsuit turns moot in terms of preserving the Crew here, and perhaps it morphs into a claim for damages. On the other hand, if the city and the state are able to achieve a preliminary order that the Crew can't be moved, it creates a huge change in the leverage of the parties, and maybe it makes it more likely that something is negotiated that's acceptable to the community that has the Crew remaining.
As far as how Anthony Precourt has announced all of this, the vagueness within his announcement, even though everybody knows he's looking very closely at Austin and that Austin people are working to negotiate deals on this score for locations and so forth, how does that play into whether or not the law could be used in this case?
Well, there's a factual issue of whether they've made the decision to move the team, and so where there's smoke, often there's fire. We're in litigation. It gives the state and the city the opportunity to engage in discovery, and that's to look through internal communications of not only Precourt's organization but the league itself, and to see if there's any you know, it's probably a bevy of emails, letters, what have you, and it may indicate that a decision has been made. That's very possible. So that could help trigger, you know, the part of the law. It seems like from what Representative Duffy has uncovered, and he's done a great job as a Sherlock Holmes, you know, the amount of aid given to the crew. The next step is, well, has there really been a decision to move? And it may be possible to prove that with the documents within those two organizations.
If anyone has a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. And Jeff in Pickerington, you're on the air. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, Ann. How are you doing this morning?
Good, thanks.
So I have a couple of questions. My first one is, what are the odds that if this does come into a courtroom, that pre-court could make the argument that other events held at the stadium would cover the lost revenue from the crew? And then I'll follow that up with, is there an argument that they could make that because they didn't utilize the tax incentive or the $5 million that they had allotted to them and
for the Obetz facility?
Right, for the Obetz facility. Mm-hmm. And going back further than that, I mean, how far does the law have effect as far as them taking public money before they have the ability to?
Okay. Mike Duffy, any sense about that?
My sense is that the law doesn't make a question as to a timeline. Sorry, I'm getting a little echo.
Mm-hmm.
So from the inception of them getting money, it would apply.
Okay, so there is no time frame in the law. It doesn't say within 60 days or 6 years or 10 years or anything.
No, I mean, it's any time after the effective date of the law, June 20th, 1996.
All right, we will continue our conversation. Once again, if you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org. With us, Mike Duffy, State Representative of the 21st District in Ohio, and also James Maniacci. He is a local lawyer. He's been commenting on the legal issues surrounding the Modell Law, which the state and the city are using against Anthony Precourt, owner of the Columbus Crew Soccer Club and also the Major League Soccer in their efforts or against them in their efforts to move the crew to Austin. Also with us, Morgan Hughes. He's one of the leaders of the Save the Crew movement. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. You just heard a bit from the theme song for the Columbus Crew Soccer Club, which may call the 2018 season its last in Ohio's capital city. Team owner Anthony Precourt has announced plans to move the team to Austin, Texas. Both the state of Ohio and the city of Columbus have sued Precourt, who has been working hand-in-hand with Major League Soccer on the move. Still with us is leader of the Save the Crew movement, Morgan Hughes. By phone, State Representative Mike Duffy, who first came up with the idea of suing the Precourt and Major League Soccer on the basis of a law that's never been tested before, the Modell Law. And also with us, lawyer James Maniacci. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. James Maniacci, what's in play here when it comes to Major League Soccer being named in this lawsuit? Does it open them up for other similar kinds of lawsuits, or would it only be just Ohio be affected?
Well, it's an Ohio law, so mm-hmm. It would have to be something related to an Ohio team. But it is a step of saying that the state and the city intends to hold them responsible. What has been filed in court doesn't ask for damages yet. You know, it's just saying, don't move. You know, follow the law. But there, you know, there's certainly the possibility, let's just say that the team does move, notwithstanding the lawsuit, that the city and the state could take action against, you know, MLS and the crew organization for damages.
Mike Duffy, sports is a business. Why shouldn't owners be allowed to make the best decisions, or make the decisions best or not, for their own team, for their own business?
They should be able to, and they made a conscious decision to accept public money, and that public money essentially entered into a contract with the state. They're, you know, if you're a company and you go for jobs incentive with the state of Ohio, you've now entered into a responsibility contract with the state. You've gotten money, you have to create the job. Don't create the job, you got to return the money. That's the way that program runs. The way this money for sports facilities runs under the Modell Law, which, again, nobody has challenged it since 1996. It's been longstanding Ohio law. It's untested, but I think the language is relatively plain, is if you go for public money, you can't move the team unless you give 6 months' notice, and you have to give the opportunity to purchase the team to the political subdivision where you reside, which is Columbus, and any individual or group of individuals who reside in the area, who represent a broadly a class of taxpayers, Ohio taxpayers, who funded your facility. So in a way, you've entered into an investment contract with the state of Ohio.
Brian in Upper Arlington, you're on the air. Hi, Brian.
Hi, how's it going today?
Good, thanks.
So my question would be how the Modell Law holds up against the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. When same-sex marriage was made illegal in California under Proposition 8, the argument to legalize same-sex marriage at the Supreme Court was that Prop 8 specifically targeted one segment of the population, penalizing them. And that helped to overturn same-sex marriage bans throughout the country. Here with the Modell Law, we have a law that specifically targets one group of business owners. We've had other businesses leave that have received public assistance. NCR comes to mind, as well as some others, and they have not been penalized. So how does this law hold up, or how did the, how do your guests feel like this law will hold up in that situation? And I will take my, or listen to the comments off the air.
Okay, thanks, Brian. James Maniacci?
I think the better constitutional argument would be that this is a restraint against interstate commerce. And I think that and the vagueness of the law in terms of what the remedy is, you know, people are supposed to have an opportunity to purchase. There's really, it's really undefined what that is. I'm not saying that that argument that the gentleman who called in couldn't be made. And I'm not saying that a restriction against interstate commerce is necessarily a winner, but it's like, as Representative Duffy said, we'd expect this to be removed to federal court, and it, that would be a great venue for someone to bring up, you know, U.S. constitutional issues is, in an attempt to invalidate the law.
Alex in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Alex.
Hey, thanks for having me. I'm so excited to be here. Sure. My question is, at what point would it make sense for the Columbus Partners or any interested party to kind of show their hand, and if they are in fact interested, put the offer on the table? I think that'd be pretty dang cool.
I'm wondering, Morgan Hughes, can you speak to that? Has anybody stepped up to the plate? I hate all these sports analogies, but you know what I mean?
Well, yeah. So one of the, if not the most difficult and uncomfortable reality of this thing, of this movement, has been we don't know much of anything. There's been talks of parallel paths. There's been talks of offers being made by local potential minority or complete owners, and we don't know. And so we don't have a target date for the end of this. We don't know when the next statement will be made. So I think Alex from Columbus's question is valid. When, you know, we would love to know details as a movement, and I agree, it's pretty dang cool.
Mike Duffy, what's known out there? I mean, if nobody is going to make an offer, if nobody has, what kind of leg do you have to stand on in that regard?
Well, I think, you know, according to the letter of the law, if let's say we had a good faith effort from pre-court sports ventures, which I don't think we have right now, and I think that's going to be something that the court's going to take under consideration and is part of the Attorney General's filing, essentially, that they're not communicative. If they were saying that they were going to cease to play games and they said, all right, we're giving you the 6 months notice, who's going to offer to buy the team? Then we have an obligation, obviously, locally to put up or shut up. Somebody has to make a bona fide offer at that time or else they're going to say we satisfied the letter of the law. You know, you'll wait for the 6 months to expire, and then they're going to leave town. So I do think that there's a time for that conversation, but pre-court's going to need to announce formally, if he hasn't already, and there's debate about that, that he wants to move and cease playing most of the home games at the facility, which is the letter of the law. Mm-hmm. You have to notice that the owner's intention to cease playing most of the home games at the facility, not I'm exploring another place or I'm thinking about building a facility. That's not – I mean, that maybe implies that you're going to cease playing most of your home games. We have to actually provide that notice, and then that opportunity has to be publicly announced, I assume, as part of that, essentially, that the law has been triggered and that people need to make offers.
Fred in Grove City, you're on the air. Hi, Fred.
Hi there. Now that we're building a case for how much the public has invested, do we have some kind of a statement as to is it worth it to the community? That what we've been spending on the crew, is it worth it to keep them?
Okay, so has anyone crunched the numbers on what the value is to the community? Mike Duffy?
Speak up a little bit to that, and that is to say, I think that there's broadly a sense among many taxpayers as to question as to why public money should go into professional sports at all, mm-hmm. or any private enterprise. But even if you agree with that analysis, you would say money that has already been spent and that triggered a state law should be protected. Taxpayer money should be protected, regardless of whether you agree that public money should have gone in there in the first place. And the letter of the law is a penny. So it doesn't matter if it was $30 million or $1, they triggered the Modell law. And it wasn't something that was done to them under duress. You know, they voluntarily sought it. They lobbied for it. They hired lobbyists to go seek public money. And so they entered into that situation.
Okay. Fred, thanks a lot. Email from Carrie. Is there a potential to reconcile? How do we get the crew soccer club leadership back to Columbus to move forward? Is there any way that our Columbus Crew family can live with this ownership staying here? Interesting question. Morgan Hughes, just emotionally.
Yeah.
What do you think?
So we've been saying from the beginning of the Save the Crew movement that it's never too late to do the right thing. There are three important things we have on our side as a movement. One, we are right. It is right to protect a community. Two, there are very talented people in our community. And three, we live in the smartest city in the world. So when you combine all three of those variables, I think anything can be figured out. We've put ourselves forward as a city, as a place that is collaborative and that is smart and that is forward thinking. What a great opportunity it is for us as a city to prove to the rest of the world that you don't have to be from Columbus to work in Columbus. And you don't have to be from here to invest in here. You invest in us, we invest in you. It's never too late to do the right thing, and conversations are welcomed. We welcome this talk of parallel paths. We can't wait.
But, you know, Mike Duffy, there haven't been any conversations, it seems like. That's what we keep hearing, that he's really, Anthony Precourt is really not engaging in conversation, and the city and the state haven't been able to make inroads there as well.
Yeah, so I think one thing about to look at this, and I think this is a comforting thought, is that history repeats itself. And when the move was announced in Cleveland, it wasn't that the two parties, the city of Cleveland and the Browns ownership, came to some amicable agreement and decided not to move. It was litigation-based. The litigation brought them to the table, and there, just as James Maniacci mentioned, a settlement occurred. And that settlement was not enforcement of the law. It wasn't the penalty. You know, ultimately, the court didn't decide it. The settlement was, all right, you get to move because you probably don't want to be in this town anymore because of all the psychic damage that has occurred. And they get an expansion team, and they get to keep the shield, they get to keep the name and all the assets and the records and all that kind of stuff. It's the same team. It's an expansion. So I see that as a very realistic possibility, is that MLS is going to look at this and they're going to go, oh, my God, discovery. They're going to be looking at our private emails.
Mm-hmm.
Then they're going to say, then there's questions, and I would encourage you to talk to James about this as well. What if we start discovering things that look like they violate federal antitrust law? I mean, MLS is organized in a very unusual way. It's called single entity. Technically, Precourt doesn't actually own the team. He's an investor operator, and MLS mm-hmm. actually owns the team. So mm-hmm. that's why MLS is the defendant. And all of this raises really interesting questions that, you know, Congress has looked into as it relates to the NFL and other professional sports, to say, like, you know, is this a free market? Are they doing things like, when you put an Austin clause in, are you doing things that are blocking other people from really having a competitive environment? And in some way, is it collusionary or does it violate antitrust law? We don't have much to say about that right now, but the discovery process, I think, could start to reveal some things about MLS.
Well, you know, an email from Tom picks up from where you're leaving off. Any chance that the MLS could shut the Columbus franchise and open an Austin one without triggering the Modell law? This is like what Modell did. James Maniacci, what about that?
I have no idea. I really don't know what the internal governing agreements within the MLS, uh-huh. whether they allow themselves to do that. You know, plus that could be even a worse position for the crew in terms of this lawsuit. You know, the problem, like all of us, are to some degree, you know, on this call speculating, because we don't know what each party has in its poker hand. You know, but all the speculation, any of this could be accurate. There could also be some facts that we're not aware of that totally change how this would play out legally. I think the big picture is the city and the state, by engaging in this process, can get a little bit more leverage, a little bit more communication, and the chances of some sort of settlement are enhanced. You know, as far as the MLS being involved, a new expansion team, my understanding is the price tag is $200 million. Well, there's only one party that has the ability to negotiate off that number, and that'd be the MLS. So if we have a new team come in here as a result of negotiations, mm-hmm. their involvement is critical, because maybe they can make it a little bit better deal for whoever the ownership group would be coming in as the new ownership group in Columbus.
And I want to talk a little bit about the idea of turning it into kind of a fake team and taking the money and run. Mm-hmm. It reminds me a little bit of that Tommy Thompson case that everyone's read about, where he went out and found the gold, and he won't tell the judge where the gold's at, and he's hiding the gold, and he's been put in contempt of court. Precourt cannot hide the gold. MLS cannot hide the gold. The value in 9.67 is the team, and if you try to turn it into something that has less value, you're fraudulently stealing the interest of the state of Ohio's taxpayers as espoused in Ohio Revised Code 9.67. I don't think that an Ohio judge is going to do that.
We just have about 30 seconds. Morgan Hughes?
I just wanted to simplify this. You know, there's a team that exists. And there's a league that has the ability to create additional franchises. If Anthony Precourt wants so desperately to be in Austin, then they should make that happen and leave the crew alone, put it in local ownership hands. Let us take this thing to the next level. We are the charter member. We were the first team, and we deserve to be here.
And just a few seconds left, but email from Steven asks, what do fans do? Should they not go protest? By not going, should they go to the games? What are you telling fans to do, Morgan Hughes?
Well, I think that's a personal decision that each individual has to make on their own. But I would say that I'll be there. It's going to be a great time. I invite you to join me. Fill the fray, save the crew.
Thanks for joining us, Morgan Hughes. I appreciate it. Morgan Hughes, one of the leaders of the Save the Crew movement, state representative for the 21st District, Mike Duffy. Thanks to you as well. I appreciate your time.
Thank you all.
And James Maniacci, a local lawyer, talking about the issues involved in this lawsuit against the Columbus Crew Soccer Club. James, thank you. I appreciate your time.
Thank you much. Take care.
Thanks to everybody else for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.